far, far away from the man who was really Count Olaf. Chapter 5. The expression "following suit" is a curious one, because it has nothing to do with walking behind a matching set of clothing. If you follow suit, it means you do the same thing somebody else has just done. If all of your friends decided to jump off a bridge into the icy waters of an ocean or river, for instance, and you jumped in right after them, you would be following suit. You can see why following suit can be a dangerous thing to do, because you could end up drowning simply because somebody else thought of it first. This is why, when Violet stood up from the hay and said, "How do you do, Coach Genghis?" Klaus and Sunny were reluctant to follow suit. It was inconceivable to the younger Baudelaires that their sister had not recognized Count Olaf, and that she hadn't leapt to her feet and informed Vice-Principal Nero what was going on. For a moment, Klaus and Sunny even considered that Violet had been hypnotized, as Klaus had been back when the Baudelaire orphans were living in Paltryville. But Violet's eyes did not look any wider than they did normally, nor did she say, "How do you do, Coach Genghis?" in the dazed tone of voice Klaus had used when he had been under hypnosis. But although they were puzzled, the younger Baudelaires trusted their sister absolutely. She had managed to avoid marrying Count Olaf when it had seemed like it would be inevitable, a word which here means a lifetime of horror and woe. She had made a lockpick when they needed one in a hurry, and had used her inventing skills to help them escape from some very hungry leeches. So even though they could not think what the reason was, Klaus and Sunny knew that Violet must have had a good reason to greet Count Olaf politely, rather than reveal him instantly, and so, after a pause, they followed suit. "How do you do, Coach Genghis?" Klaus said.
"Gefido!" Sunny shrieked.
"It's a pleasure to meet you,"
Coach Genghis said, and smirked. The Baudelaires could tell he thought he had fooled them completely and was very pleased with himself.
"What do you think, Coach Genghis?" Vice-Principal Nero asked. "Do any of these orphans have the legs you're looking for?"
Coach Genghis scratched his turban and looked down at the children as if they were an all-you-can-eat salad bar instead of five orphans.
"Oh, yes,"
he said, in the wheezy voice the Baudelaires still heard in their nightmares. With his bony hands, he pointed first at Violet, then at Klaus, and lastly at Sunny.
"These three children here are just what I'm looking for, all right. I have no use for these twins, however."
"Neither do I," Nero said,
not bothering to point out that the Quagmires were triplets. He then looked at his watch.
"Well, it's time for my concert. Follow me to the auditorium, all of you, unless you're in the mood to buy me a bag of candy."
The Baudelaire orphans hoped never to buy their vice-principal a gift of any sort, let alone a bag of candy, which the children loved and hadn't eaten in a very long time. So they followed Nero out of the orphan's shack and across the lawn to the auditorium. The Quagmires followed suit, staring up at the gravestone buildings, which looked even spookier in the moonlight.
"This evening," Nero said, "I will be playing a violin sonata I wrote myself. It only lasts about a half hour, but I will play it 12 times in a row."
"Oh, good," Coach Genghis said. "If I may say so, Vice Principal Nero, I am an enormous fan of your music. Your concerts were one of the main reasons I wanted to work here at Prufrock Prep."
"Well, it's good to hear that," Nero said. "It's difficult to find people who appreciate me as the genius I am."
"I know the feeling," Coach Genghis said. "I'm the finest gym teacher the world has ever seen. And yet there hasn't even been one parade in my honor."
"Shocking,"
Nero said, shaking his head. The Baudelaires and the Quagmires, who were walking behind the adults, looked at one another in disgust at the braggy conversation they were overhearing, but they didn't dare speak to one another until they arrived at the auditorium, taking seats as far away as possible from Carmelita Spatz and her loathsome friends. There is one, and only one, advantage to somebody who cannot play the violin insisting on doing so anyway. And the advantage is that they often play so loudly that they cannot hear if the audience is having a conversation. It is extremely rude, of course, for an audience to talk during a concert performance, but when the performance is a wretched one and lasts 6 hours, such rudeness can be forgiven. So it was that evening, for after introducing himself with a brief, braggy speech, Vice Principal Nero stood on the stage of the auditorium and began playing his sonata for the first time. When you listen to a piece of classical music, it is often amusing to try and guess what inspired the composer to write those particular notes. Sometimes a composer will be inspired by nature and will write a symphony imitating the sounds of birds and trees. Other times a composer will be inspired by the city and will write a concerto imitating the sounds of traffic and sidewalks. In the case of this sonata, Nero had apparently been inspired by somebody beating up a cat, because the music was loud and screechy and made it quite easy to talk during the performance. As Nero sawed away at his violin, the students of Prufrock Prep began to talk amongst themselves. The Baudelaires even noticed Mr. Romora and Mrs. Bass, who were supposed to be figuring out which students owed Nero bags of candy, giggling and sharing a banana in the back row. Only Coach Genghis, who was sitting in the center of the very front row, seemed to be paying any attention to the music. "Our new gym teacher looks creepy," Isadora said. "That's for sure," Duncan agreed. "It's that sneaky look in his eye." "That sneaky look," Violet said, taking a sneaky look herself to make sure Coach Genghis wasn't listening in, "is because he's not really Coach Genghis. He's not really any coach. He's Count Olaf in disguise." "I knew you recognized him," Klaus said. "Count Olaf," Duncan said. "How awful. How did he follow you here?" "Stuach," Sunny said glumly. "My sister means something like he follows us everywhere," Violet explained, "and she's right. But it doesn't matter how he found us. The point is that he's here, and that he undoubtedly has a scheme to snatch our fortune." "But why did you pretend not to recognize him?" Klaus asked. "Yes," Isadora said. "If you told Vice Principal Nero that he was really Count Olaf, then Nero could throw the cake sniffer out of here, if you'll pardon my language." Violet shook her head to indicate that she disagreed with Isadora and that she didn't mind about cake sniffer. "Olaf's too clever for that," she said. "I knew that if I tried to tell Nero he wasn't really a gym teacher, he would manage to wiggle out of it, just as he did with Aunt Josephine and Uncle Monty and everybody else." "That's good thinking," Klaus admitted. "Plus, if Olaf thinks that he's fooled us, it might give us some more time to figure out exactly what he's up to." "Lert," Sunny pointed out. "My sister means that we can see if any of his assistants are around," Violet translated. "That's a good point, Sunny. I hadn't thought of that." "Count Olaf has assistants?" Isadora asked. "That's not fair. He's bad enough without people helping him." "His assistants are as bad as he is," Klaus said. "There are two powder-faced women who forced us to be in his play. There's a hook-handed man who helped Olaf murder our Uncle Monty. And the bald man who bossed us around at the lumber mill. Don't forget him," Violet added. "Aginu," Sunny said, which meant something like, "and the assistant that looks like neither a man nor a woman." "What does Aginu mean?" Duncan asked, taking out his notebook. "I'm going to write down all these details about Olaf and his troop." "Why?" Violet asked. "Why?" Isadora repeated. "Because we're going to help you, that's why. You don't think we'd just sit here while you tried to escape from Olaf's clutches, would you?" "But Count Olaf is very dangerous," Klaus said. "If you try and help us, you'll be risking your lives." "Never mind about that," Duncan said, "although I am sorry to tell you that the Quagmire triplets should have minded about that. They should have minded very much. Duncan and Isadora were very brave and caring to try and help the Baudelaire orphans, but bravery often demands a price. By price, I do not mean something along the lines of $5. I mean a much, much bigger price. A price so dreadful that I cannot speak of it now, but must return to the scene I am writing at this moment." "Never mind about that," Duncan said. "What we need is a plan. Now, we need to prove to Nero that Coach Genghis is really Count Olaf. How can we do that?" "Nero has that computer," Violet said thoughtfully. "He showed us a little picture of Olaf on the screen, remember?" "Yes," Klaus said, shaking his head. "He told us that the advanced computer system would keep Olaf away. So much for computers." Sunny nodded her head in agreement, and Violet picked her up and put her on her lap. Nero had reached a particularly shrieky section of his sonata, and the children had to lean forward to one another in order to continue their conversation. "If we go and see Nero first thing tomorrow morning," Violet said, "we can talk to him alone, without Olaf butting in. We'll ask him to use the computer. Nero might not believe us, but the computer should be able to convince him to at least investigate Coach Genghis." "Maybe Nero will make him take off the turban," Isadora said, revealing Olaf's only eyebrow. Or take off those expensive-looking running shoes, Klaus said, revealing Olaf's tattoo. But if you talk to Nero, Duncan said, then Coach Genghis will know that you're suspicious. That's why we'll have to be extra careful, Violet said. We want Nero to find out about Olaf without Olaf finding out about us. And in the meantime, Duncan said, Isadora and I will do some investigating ourselves. Perhaps we can spot one of these assistants you've described. That would be very useful, Violet said, if you're sure about wanting to help us. Say no more about it, Duncan said, and patted Violet's hand. And they said no more about it. They didn't say another word about Count Olaf for the rest of Nero's sonata, or while he performed it the second time, or the third time, or the fourth time, or the fifth time, or even the sixth time, by which time it was very, very late at night. The Baudelaire orphans and the Quagmire triplets merely sat in a companionable comfort, a phrase which here means many things, all of them happy, even though it is quite difficult to be happy, while hearing a terrible sonata performed over and over by a man who cannot play the violin, while attending an atrocious boarding school with an evil man sitting nearby, undoubtedly planning something dreadful. But happy moments came rarely and unexpectedly in the Baudelaires' lives, and the three siblings had learned to accept them. Duncan kept his hand on Violet's and talked to her about terrible concerts he had attended back when the Quagmire parents were alive, and she was happy to hear his stories. Isadora began working on a poem about libraries and showed Klaus what she had written in her notebook, and Klaus was happy to offer suggestions. And Sunny snuggled down in Violet's lap and chewed on the armrest of her seat, happy to bite something that was so sturdy. I'm sure you would know, even if I didn't tell you, that things were about to get much worse for the Baudelaires. But I will end this chapter with this moment of companionable comfort, rather than skip ahead to the unpleasant events of the next morning, or the terrible trials of the days that followed, or the horrific crime that marked the end of the Baudelaires' time at Prufrock Prep. These things happened, of course, and there is no use pretending they didn't. But for now, let us ignore the terrible sonata, the dreadful teachers, the nasty, teasing students, and the even more wretched things that will be happening soon enough. Let us enjoy this brief moment of comfort, as the Baudelaires enjoyed it in the company of the Quagmire triplets, and, in Sunny's case, an armrest. Let us enjoy, at the end of this chapter, the last happy moment any of these children would have for a long, long time. Chapter 6 Prufrock Preparatory School is now closed. It has been closed for many years, ever since Mrs. Bass was arrested for bank robbery, and if you were to visit it now, you would find it an empty and silent place. If you walked on the lawn, you would not see any children running around, as there were the day the Baudelaires arrived. If you walked by the building containing the classrooms, you would not hear the drowning voice of Mr. Ramora telling a story, and if you walked by the building containing the auditorium, you would not hear the scrapings and shriekings of Vice Principal Nero playing the violin. If you went and stood beneath the arch, looking up at the black letters spelling out the name of the school and its austere, a word which here means stern and severe, motto, you would hear nothing but the swish of the breeze through the brown and patchy grass. In short, if you went and visited Prufrock Preparatory School today, the academy would look more or less as it did when the Baudelaires woke up early the next morning and walked to the administrative building to talk to Nero about Coach Genghis. The three children were so anxious to talk to him that they got up especially early, and as they walked across the lawn, it felt as if everyone else at Prufrock Prep had slipped away in the middle of the night, leaving the orphans alone amongst the tombstone-shaped buildings. It was an eerie feeling, which is why Violet and Sunny were surprised when Klaus broke the silence by laughing suddenly. "What are you snickering at?" Violet asked. "I just realized something," Klaus said. "We're going to the administrative building without an appointment. We'll have to eat our meals without silverware." "There's nothing funny about that," Violet said. "What if they serve oatmeal for breakfast? We'll have to scoop it up with our hands." "Oot," Sunny said, which meant, "Trust me, it's not that difficult." And at that, the Baudelaire sisters joined their brother in laughter. It was not funny, of course, that Nero enforced such terrible punishments, but the idea of eating oatmeal with their hands gave all three siblings the giggles. "Or fried eggs," Violet said. "What if they serve runny fried eggs?" or pancakes covered in syrup, Klaus said.
Soup!
Sunny shrieked, and they all broke out in laughter again. Remember the picnic? Violet said. We were going to Rutabaga River for a picnic, and Father was so excited about the meal he made that he forgot to pack silverware.
Of course I remember, Klaus said. We had to eat all that sweet and sour shrimp with our hands.
Sticky, Sunny said, holding her hands up. It sure was, Violet agreed. Afterward, we went to wash our hands in the river, and we found a perfect place to try the fishing rod I made.
And I picked blackberries with Mother, Klaus said.
Irus, Sunny said, which meant something like, and I bit rocks. The children stopped laughing now as they remembered that afternoon, which hadn't been so very long ago, but felt like it had happened in the distant, distant past. After the fire, the children had known their parents were dead, of course, but it had felt like they had merely gone away somewhere and would be back before long. Now, remembering the way the sunlight had shone on the water of Rutabaga River, and the laughter of their parents as they made a mess of themselves eating sweet and sour shrimp, the picnic seemed so far away that they knew their parents were never coming back.
Maybe we'll go back there, Violet said quietly. Maybe someday we can visit the river again and catch fish and pick blackberries.
Maybe we can, Klaus said, but the Baudelaires all knew that even if someday they went back to Rutabaga River, which they never did, by the way, that it would not be the same.
Maybe we can, but in the meantime we've got to talk to Nero. Come on, here's the administrative building.
The Baudelaire sighed and walked into the building, surrendering the use of Prufrock Prep's silverware. They climbed the stairs to the 9th floor and knocked on Nero's door, surprised they could not hear him practicing the violin.
Come in if you must,
Nero said, and the orphans walked in. Nero had his back to his door, looking at his reflection in the window as he tied a rubber band around one of his pigtails. When he was finished, he held both hands up in the air.
"Ladies and gentlemen, Vice Principal Nero!"
he announced, and the children began applauding obediently. Nero whirled around.
"I only expected to hear one person clapping," he said sternly. "Violet and Klaus, you're not allowed up here. You know that."
"I beg your pardon, sir," Violet said, "but all three of us have something very important we need to discuss with you."
"All three of us have something very important we need to discuss with you,"
Nero replied in his usual nasty way.
"It must be important for you to sacrifice your silverware privileges. Well, well, out with it. I have a lot of rehearsing to do for my next concert, so don't waste my time."
"This won't take long," Klaus promised. He paused before continuing, which is a good thing to do if you're choosing your words very, very carefully. "We are concerned," he continued, choosing his words very, very carefully, "that Count Olaf may have somehow managed to get to Prufrock Prep."
"Nonsense," Nero said. "Now go away and let me practice the violin."
"But it might not be nonsense," Violet said. "Olaf is a master of disguise. He could be right under our very noses and we wouldn't know it."
"The only thing under my nose," Nero said, "is my mouth, which is telling you to leave."
"Count Olaf could be Mr. Remora," Klaus said, "or Mrs. Bass."
"Mr. Remora and Mrs. Bass have taught at this school for more than 47 years, Nero said dismissively. "I would know if one of them were in disguise."
"What about the people who work at the cafeteria?" Violet asked. "They're always wearing those metal masks."
"Those are for safety, not for disguises," Nero said. "You brats have some very silly ideas. Next you'll be seeing that Count Olaf has disguised himself as your boyfriend. What's his name, the triplet?"
Violet blushed. "Duncan Quagmire is not my boyfriend," she said. "And he's not Count Olaf, either." But Nero was too busy making idiotic jokes to listen.
"Who knows?" he asked, and then laughed again. "He, he, he. Maybe he's disguised himself as Carmelita Spatz." "Or me,"
came a voice from the doorway. The Baudelaires whirled around and saw Coach Genga standing there with a red rose in his hand and a fierce look in his eye.
"Or you," Nero said. "He, he, he. Imagine this Olaf fellow pretending to be the finest gym teacher in the country."
Klaus looked at Coach Genghis and thought of all the trouble he had caused, whether he was pretending to be Uncle Monty's assistant Stefano, or Captain Sham, or Shirley, or any of the other phony names he had used. Klaus wanted desperately to say, "You are Count Olaf."
But he knew that if the Baudelaires pretended that Coach Genghis was fooling them, they had a better chance of revealing his plan, whatever it was. So he bit his tongue, a phrase which here means that he simply kept quiet. He did not actually bite his tongue, but opened his mouth and laughed.
"That would be funny," he lied. "Imagine if you really were Count Olaf. Wouldn't that be funny, Coach Genghis? That would mean your turban would really be a disguise." "My turban?"
Coach Genghis said. His fierce look melted away as he realized, incorrectly, of course, that Klaus was joking.
"A disguise? Ho, ho, ho!" "He, he, he!"
Nero laughed. Violet and Sunny both saw at once what Klaus was doing, and they followed suit.
"Oh, yes, Genghis," Violet cried, as if she were joking. "Take off your turban and show us the one eyebrow you are hiding. Ha, ha, ha!"
"You three children are really quite funny," Nero cried. "You're like three professional comedians!"
"Volasox!"
Sunny shrieked, showing all four teeth in a fake smile.
"Oh, yes," Klaus said. "Sunny is right. If you were really Olaf in disguise, then your running shoes would be covering your tattoo." "He, he, he," Nero said.
"You children are like three clowns."
"Ho, ho, ho,"
Count Olaf said.
"Ha, ha, ha,"
Violet said, who was beginning to feel queasy from faking all this laughter. Looking up at Genghis and smiling so hard that her teeth ached, she stood on tiptoe and tried to reach his turban.
"I'm going to rip this off," she said, as if she were still joking, "and show off your one eyebrow."
"He, he, he,"
Nero said, shaking his pigtails in laughter.
"You're like three trained monkeys."
Klaus crouched down to the ground and grabbed one of Genghis's feet.
"And I'm going to rip your shoes off," he said, as if he were still joking, "and show off your tattoo."
"He, he, he,"
Nero said. "You're like three."
The Baudelaires didn't get to hear what they were three of, because Coach Genghis stuck out both his arms, catching Klaus with one hand and Violet with the other.
"Ho, ho, ho,"
he said, and then abruptly stopped laughing.
"Of course,"
he said, in a tone of voice that was suddenly serious.
"I can't take off my running shoes because I've been exercising and my feet smell. And I can't take off my turban for religious reasons."
"He, he."
Nero stopped giggling and became very serious himself.
"Oh, Coach Genghis," he said, "we wouldn't ask you to violate your religious beliefs, and I certainly don't want your feet stinking up my office."
Violet struggled to reach the turban, and Klaus struggled to remove one of the evil coach's shoes, but Genghis held them both tight.
"Drat!"
Sunny shrieked.
"Joke time is over," Nero announced. "Thank you for brightening up my morning, children. Goodbye, and enjoy your breakfast without silverware. Now, Coach Genghis, what can I do for you?"
"Well, Nero," Genghis said, "I just wanted to give you this rose. A small gift of congratulations for the wonderful concert you gave us last night."
"Oh, thank you,"
Nero said, taking the rose out of Genghis's hand and giving it a good smell.
"I was wonderful, wasn't I?"
"You were perfection," Genghis said. "The first time you played your sonata, I was deeply moved. The second time, I had tears in my eyes. The third time, I was sobbing. The fourth time, I had an uncontrollable emotional attack. The fifth time..."
The Baudelaires did not hear about the fifth time, because Nero's door swung shut behind them. They looked at one another in dismay. The Baudelaires had come very close to revealing Coach Genghis's disguise, but close was not enough. They trudged silently out of the administrative building and over to the cafeteria. Evidently, Nero had already called the metal-masked cafeteria workers, because when Violet and Klaus reached the end of the line, the workers refused to hand them any silverware. Prufrock Prep was not serving oatmeal for breakfast, but Violet and Klaus knew that eating scrambled eggs at their hands was not going to be very pleasant. "Oh, don't worry about that," Isadora said, when the children slid glumly into seats beside the Quagmires. "Here, Klaus and I will take turns with my silverware, and you can share with Duncan, Violet. Tell us how everything went in Nero's office." "Not very well," Violet admitted. "Coach Genghis got there right after we did, and we didn't want him to see that we knew who he really was." Isadora pulled her notebook out of her pocket and read out loud to her friends. "It would be a stroke of luck if Coach Genghis were hit by a truck," she read. "That's my latest poem. I know it's not that helpful, but I thought you might like to hear it anyway." I did like hearing it, Klaus said. And it certainly would be a stroke of luck if that happened, but I wouldn't bet on it. Well, we'll think of another plan, Duncan said, handing Violet his fork. I hope so, Violet said. Count Olaf doesn't usually wait very long to put his evil schemes into action.
Cosball! Sunny shrieked.
Does Sunny mean I have a plan? Isadora asked. I'm trying to get the hang of her way of talking.
I think she means something more like, here comes Carmelita Spatz, Klaus said, pointing across the cafeteria.
Sure enough, Carmelita Spatz was walking toward their table with a big, smug smile on her face.
Hello, you cake sniffers,
she said.
I have a message for you from Coach Genghis. I get to be his special messenger because I'm the cutest, prettiest, nicest girl in the whole school.
Oh, stop bragging, Carmelita, Duncan said.
You're just jealous,
Carmelita replied.
Because Coach Genghis likes me best instead of you.
I couldn't care less about Coach Genghis, Duncan said. Just deliver your message and leave us alone.
The message is this,
Carmelita said.
The three Baudelaire orphans are to report to the front lawn tonight, immediately after dinner.
After dinner, Violet said. But after dinner, we're supposed to go to Nero's violin recital.
That's the message,
Carmelita insisted.
He said that if you don't show up, you'll be in big trouble. So if I were you, Violet...
You aren't Violet, thank goodness, Duncan interrupted. It is not very polite to interrupt a person, of course. But sometimes, if the person is very unpleasant, you can hardly stop yourself. Thank you for your message. Goodbye.
It is traditional,
Carmelita said,
to give a special messenger a tip after she has delivered a message.
If you don't leave us alone, Isadora said, you're going to get a headful of scrambled eggs as a tip.
You're just a jealous cake sniffer,
Carmelita sneered, but she left the Baudelaires
and Quagmires
Duncan alone.
Don't worry,
Duncan said when he was sure Carmelita couldn't hear him. It's still morning. We have all day to figure out what to do. Here, have another spoonful of eggs, Violet.
No, thank you, Violet said. I don't have much of an appetite. And it was true.
None of the Baudelaires had an appetite. Scrambled eggs had never been the siblings' favorite dish, particularly Sunny, who much preferred food she could really sink her teeth into. But their lack of appetite had nothing to do with the eggs. It had to do with Coach Genghis, of course, and the message that he had sent to them. It had to do with the thought of meeting him on the lawn, after dinner, all alone. Duncan was right that it was still morning, and that they had all day to figure out what to do. But it did not feel like morning. Violet, Klaus, and Sunny sat in the cafeteria, not taking another bite of their breakfast, and it felt like the sun had already set. It felt like night had already fallen, and that Coach Genghis was already waiting for them. It was only morning, and the Baudelaire orphans already felt like they were in his clutches.
Chapter 7
The Baudelaire orphans' school day was particularly austere. A word which here means that Mr. Remora's stories were particularly boring, Mrs. Bass's obsession with the metric system was particularly irritating, and Nero's administrative demands were particularly difficult. But Violet, Klaus, and Sunny did not really notice. Violet sat at her school desk, and anybody who did not know Violet would have thought she was paying close attention, because her hair was tied up in a ribbon to keep it out of her eyes. But Violet's thoughts were far, far away from the dull tales Mr. Remora was telling. She had tied her hair up, of course, to help focus her keen inventing brain on the problem that was facing the Baudelaires, and she didn't want to waste an ounce of her attention on the rambling, banana-eating man in the front of the room. Mrs. Bass had brought in a box of pencils for her class, and was having them figure out if one of them was any longer or shorter than the rest. And if Mrs. Bass weren't so busy pacing around the room shouting, "Measure!" she might have looked at Klaus and thought that perhaps he shared her obsession with measurement, because his eyes were sharply focused as if he were concentrating. But Klaus was spending the morning on autopilot, a word which here means measuring pencils without really thinking about them. As he placed pencil after pencil next to his ruler, he was thinking of books he had read that might be helpful for their situation. And if Vice Principal Nero had stopped practicing his violin and looked in on his infant secretary, he would have guessed that Sunny was working very hard,
mailing letters he had dictated to various candy companies complaining about their candy quality. But even though Sunny was typing, stapling, and stamping as quickly as she could, her mind was not on secretarial supplies, but on the appointment she and her siblings had with Coach Genghis that evening, and what they could do about it. The Quagmires were curiously absent from lunch, so the Baudelaires were really forced to eat with their hands this time. But as they picked up handfuls of spaghetti and tried to eat them as neatly as possible, the three children were thinking so hard that they barely spoke. They knew, almost without discussing the matter, that none of them had been able to guess Coach Genghis's plan, and that they hadn't figured out a way to avoid their appointment with him on the lawn, an appointment that drew closer and closer with every handful of lunch. The Baudelaires passed the afternoon in more or less the same way, ignoring Mr. Remora's stories, Mrs. Bass's pencils, and the diminishing supply of staples, and even during gym period, one of Carmelita's bratty friends informed them that Genghis would start teaching the next day, but in the meantime they were to run around as usual. The three children raced around the lawn in utter silence, devoting all of their brain power to thinking about their situation. The Baudelaires had been so very quiet, and thinking so very hard, that when the Quagmires sat down across from them at dinner time and said in unison, "We've solved your problem," it was more of a startle than a relief. "Goodness," Violet said, "you startled me." "I thought you'd be relieved," Duncan said. "Didn't you hear us? We said we've solved your problem." "We're startled and relieved," Klaus said. "What do you mean, you've solved our problem? My sisters and I have been thinking about it all day, and we've gotten nowhere. We don't know what Coach Genghis is up to, although we're sure he's up to something, and we don't know how we can avoid meeting him after dinner, although we're sure that he'll do something terrible if we do." "At first I thought he might simply be planning to kidnap us," Violet said. "But he wouldn't have to be in disguise to do that." "And at first I thought we should call Mr. Poe after all," Klaus said, "and tell him what's going on. But if Count Olaf can fool an advanced computer, he'll surely be able to fool an average banker." "Teresa," Sunny said in agreement. "Duncan and I have been thinking about it all day, too," Isadora said. "I filled up 5.5 pages of my notebook writing down possible ideas, and Duncan filled up 3. "I write smaller," Duncan explained, handing his fork to Violet so she could take her turn at the meatloaf they were having for dinner. "Right before lunch we compared notes," Isadora continued, "and the two of us had the same idea, so we sneaked away and put our plan into action." "That's why we weren't at lunch," Duncan explained. "You'll notice that there are puddles of beverages on our tray instead of glasses." "Well, you can share our glasses," Klaus said, handing his to Isadora, "just like you're letting us share your silverware. But what is your plan? What did you put into action?" Duncan and Isadora looked at one another, smiled, and leaned in close to the Baudelaires so they could be sure no one would overhear. "We propped open the back door of the auditorium," Duncan said. He and Isadora smiled triumphantly and leaned back in their chairs. The Baudelaires did not feel triumphant. They felt confused. They did not want to insult their friends, who had broken the rules and sacrificed their drinking glasses just to help them. But they were unable to see how propping open the back door of the auditorium was a solution to the trouble in which they found themselves. "I'm sorry," Violet said, after a pause. "I don't understand how propping open the back door of the auditorium solves our problem." "Don't you see?" Isadora asked. "We're going to sit in the back of the auditorium tonight, and as soon as Nero begins his concert, we will tiptoe out and sneak over to the front lawn. That way we can keep an eye on you and Coach Genghis. If anything fishy happens, we will run back to the concert and alert Vice Principal Nero." "It's the perfect plan, don't you think?" Duncan asked. "I'm rather proud of my sister and me, if I do say so myself." The Baudelaire children looked at one another doubtfully. They didn't want to disappoint their friends or criticize the plan that the Quagmire triplets had cooked up, particularly since the Baudelaires hadn't cooked up any plan themselves. But Count Olaf was so evil and so clever that the three siblings couldn't help but think that propping a door open and sneaking out to spy on him was not much of a defense against his treachery. "We appreciate you trying to solve our problem," Klaus said gently, "but Count Olaf is an extremely treacherous person. He always has something up his sleeve. I wouldn't want you to get into any danger on our behalf." "Don't talk nonsense," Isadora said firmly, taking a sip from Violet's glass. "You're the ones in danger, and it's up to us to help you. And we're not frightened of Olaf. I'm confident this plan is a good one."
The Baudelaires looked at one another again. It was very brave of the Quagmire triplets not to be frightened of Olaf and to be so confident about their plan. But the three siblings could not help but wonder if the Quagmires should be so brave. Olaf was such a wretched man that it seemed wise to be frightened of him, and he had defeated so many of the Baudelaires' plans that it seemed a little foolish to be so confident about this one. But the children were so appreciative of their friend's efforts that they said nothing more about the matter. In the years to come, the Baudelaire orphans would regret this, this time when they said nothing more about the matter. But in the meantime, they merely finished their dinner with the Quagmires, passing silverware and drinking glasses back and forth and trying to talk about other things. They discussed other projects they might do to improve the orphan shack and what other matters they might research in the library, and what they could do about Sonny's problem with the staples, which were running out quite rapidly, and before they knew it, dinner was over. The Quagmires hurried off to the violin recital, promising to sneak out as quickly as they could, and the Baudelaires walked out of the cafeteria and over to the front lawn. The last few rays of the sunset made the children cast long, long shadows as they walked, as if the Baudelaires had been stretched across the brown grass by some horrible mechanical device. The children looked down at their shadows, which looked as flimsy as sheets of paper, and wished with every step that they could do something else, anything else, other than meet Coach Genghis alone on the front lawn. They wished they could just keep walking under the arch, past the front lawn, and out into the world. But where could they go? The three orphans were all alone in the world. Their parents were dead, their banker was too busy to take good care of them, and their only friends were two more orphans, who the Baudelaire sincerely hoped had snuck out of the recital by now and were spying on them as they approached the solitary figure of Coach Genghis, waiting for them impatiently on the edge of the lawn. The waning light of the sunset, the word waning here means dim and making everything look extra creepy, made the shadow of the coach's turban look like a huge, deep hole.
"You're late,"
Genghis said in his scratchy voice. As the siblings reached him, they could see he had both hands behind his back as if he were hiding something.
"Your instructions were to be here right after dinner, and you're late."
"We're very sorry," Violet said, craning her neck to try and catch a glimpse of what was behind his back. "It took us a little longer to eat our dinner without silverware."
"If you were smart," Genghis said, "you would have borrowed the silverware of one of your friends."
"We never thought of that," Klaus said. When one is forced to tell atrocious lies, one often feels a guilty flutter in one's stomach, and Klaus felt such a flutter now. "You certainly are an intelligent man," he continued.
"Not only am I intelligent," Genghis agreed, "but I'm also very smart. Now let's get right to work. Even stupid children like yourselves should remember what I said about orphans having excellent bone structure for running. That's why you are about to do Special Orphan Running Exercises, or S-O-R-E for short."
"Oodaloo," Sonny shrieked. "My sister means that sounds exciting," Violet said, although "oodaloo" actually meant, "I wish you'd tell us what you're really up to, Genghis."
"I'm glad you're so enthusiastic," Genghis said. "In certain cases, enthusiasm can make up for a lack of brain power."
He took his hands from behind his back, and the children saw that he was holding a large metal can and a long, prickly brush. The can was open, and an eerie white glow was shining out at the top.
"Now, before we begin S-O-R-E, we'll need a track. This is luminous paint, which means it glows in the dark."
"How interesting," Klaus said, although he'd known what the word luminous means for 2.5 years.
"Well, if you find it so interesting," Genghis said, his eyes looking as luminous as the paint, "you can be in charge of the brush. Here."
He thrust the long, prickly brush into Klaus's hands.
"And you, little girls, can hold the paint can. I want you to paint a big circle on the grass so you can see where you are running when you start your laps. Go on, what are you waiting for?"
The Baudelaires looked at one another. What they were waiting for, of course, was Genghis revealing what he was really up to with the paint, the brush, and the ridiculous special orphan running exercises.
but in the meantime, they figured they'd better do as Genga said. Painting a big, luminous circle on the lawn didn't seem to be particularly dangerous, so Violet picked up a paint can and Klaus dipped the brush into the paint and began making a big circle. For the moment, Sunny was something of a fifth wheel, a phrase which means not in a position to do anything particularly helpful. But she crawled alongside her siblings, offering moral support.
Bigger!
Genghis called out in the dark.
Wider!
The Baudelaires followed his instructions and made the circle bigger and wider, walking farther away from Genghis and leaving a glowing trail of paint. They looked out into the gloom of the evening, wondering where the Quagmire triplets were hiding, or if, indeed, they had managed to sneak out of the recital at all. But the sun was down now, and the only thing the orphans could see was the bright circle of light they were painting on the lawn, and the dim figure of Genghis, his white turban looking like a floating skull in the night.
Bigger! Wider! All right, that's big and wide enough. Finish the circle where I am standing. Hurry up!
What do you think we're really doing? Violet whispered to her brother.
I don't know, Klaus said. I've only read 3 or 4 books on paint. I know that paint can sometimes be poisonous or cause birth defects. But Genghis isn't making us eat the circle, and you're not pregnant, of course, so I can't imagine.
Sunny wanted to add,
Gargaba!
Which meant, maybe the luminous paint is serving as some sort of glowing signal. But the Baudelaires had come full circle and were too close to Genghis to do any more talking.
I suppose that will do, orphans,
Genghis said, snatching the brush and the can of paint out of their hands.
Now, take your marks, and when I blow my whistle, begin running around the circle you've made until I tell you to stop.
What?
Violet said. As I'm sure you know, there are 2 types of what in the world. The first type simply means, excuse me, I didn't hear you, could you please repeat yourself? The second type is a little trickier. It means something more along the lines of, excuse me, I did hear you, but I can't believe that's really what you meant. And this second type is obviously the type Violet was using at this moment. She was standing right next to Genghis, so she'd obviously heard what had come out of the smelly mouth of this miserable man. But she couldn't believe that Genghis was simply going to make them run laps. He was such a sneaky and revolting person that the eldest Baudelaire simply could not accept that his scheme was only as evil as the average gym class.
What?
Genghis repeated in a mocking way. He had obviously taken a page out of Nero's book, a phrase which here means learned how to repeat things in a mocking way in order to make fun of children.
I know you heard me, little orphan girl. You're standing right next to me. Now take your marks, all of you, and begin running as soon as I blow my whistle.
But Sunny is a baby, Klaus protested. She can't really run, at least not professionally.
Then she may crawl as fast as she can, Genghis replied. Now, on your marks, get set, go!
Genghis blew his whistle, and the Baudelaire orphans began to run, pacing themselves so they could run together even though they had different sized legs. They finished one lap, and then another, and then another, and another, and then 5 more, and then another, and then 7 more, and then another, and then 3 more, and then 2 more, and then another, and then another, and then 6 more, and then they lost track. Coach Genghis kept blowing his whistle and occasionally shouted tedious and unhelpful things like,
Keep running!
Or,
Another lap!
The children looked down at the luminous circle so they could stay in a circle. And the children looked over at Genghis as he grew fainter and then clearer as they finished a lap. And the children looked out into the darkness to see if they could catch a glimpse of the Quagmires. The Baudelaires also looked at one another from time to time, but they didn't speak, not even when they were far enough away from Genghis that he could not overhear. One reason they did not speak was to conserve energy, because although the Baudelaires were in reasonably good shape, they had not run so many laps in their lives, and before too long they were breathing too hard to really discuss anything. But the other reason they did not speak was that Violet had already spoken for them when she had asked the second type of what. Coach Genghis kept blowing his whistle, and the children kept running around and around the track. and echoing in each of their minds was the second, trickier type of question. The three siblings had heard Coach Genghis, but they couldn't believe that S-O-R-E was the extent of his evil plan. The Baudelaire orphans kept running around the glowing circle until the first rays of sunrise began to reflect on the jewel in Genghis's turban, and all they could think was, what? 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 Chapter 8.
What?
Isadora asked. I said, finally, as the sun rose, Coach Genghis had us stop running laps and let us go to bed, Klaus said. My sister didn't mean that she didn't hear you, Duncan explained. She meant that she heard you, but she didn't believe that's really what you meant. And to tell you the truth, I can scarcely believe it myself, even though I saw it with my own eyes. I can't believe it either, Violet said, wincing as she took a bite of the salad that the masked people had served for lunch. It was the next afternoon, and all three Baudelaire orphans were doing a great deal of wincing, a word which here means frowning in pain, alarm, or distress. When Coach Genghis had called last night's activities S-O-R-E, he had merely used the name as an acronym for Special Orphan Running Exercises. But the three children thought that the name S-O-R-E was even more appropriate than that. After a full night of S-O-R-E, they'd been sore all day. Their legs were sore from all that running. When they'd finally entered the orphan shack to go to sleep, they had been too tired to put on their noisy shoes, so their toes were sore from the claws of the tiny territorial crabs. And their heads were sore, not only from headaches, which often occur when one doesn't get enough sleep, but also from trying to figure out what Coach Genghis was up to in making them run all those laps. The Baudelaire legs were sore, the Baudelaire toes were sore, the Baudelaire heads were sore, and soon the muscles on the sides of the Baudelaire mouths would be sore from wincing all day long. It was lunchtime, and the three children were trying to discuss the previous evening with the Quagmire triplets, who weren't very sore and not nearly as tired. One reason was that they had been hiding behind the archway, spying on Genghis and the Baudelaires, instead of running around and around the luminous circle. The other reason was that the Quagmires had done their spying in shifts. After the Baudelaires had to run the first few laps and there was no sign of them stopping, the two triplets had decided to alternate between Duncan sleeping and Isadora spying, and Duncan spying and Isadora sleeping. The two siblings promised each other that they would wake up the sleeping one if the spying one noticed anything unusual. I had the last shift, Duncan explained, so my sister didn't see the end of S-O-R-E. But it doesn't matter. All that happened was that Coach Genghis had you stop running laps and let you go to bed. I thought that he might insist on getting your fortune before you could stop running. And I thought that the luminous circle would serve as a landing strip, Isadora said, for a helicopter piloted by one of his assistants to swoop down and take you away. The only thing I couldn't figure out was why you had to run all those laps before the helicopter showed up. But the helicopter didn't show up, Klaus said, taking a sip of water and wincing. Nothing showed up. Maybe the pilot got lost, Isadora said. Or maybe Coach Genghis became as tired as you did and forgot to ask for your fortune, Duncan said. Violet shook her sore head. He would never get too tired to get our fortune, she said. He's up to something, that much is for sure, but I just can't figure out what it is. Of course you can't figure it out, Duncan said. You're exhausted. I'm glad Isadora and I thought of spying in shifts. We're going to use all our spare time to investigate. We'll go through all of our notes and do some more research in the library. There must be something that can help us figure it out.
I'll do research too, Klaus said, yawning.
I'm quite good at it. I know you are, Isadora said, smiling. But not today, Klaus. We'll work on uncovering Genghis's plan, and you three can catch up on your sleep. You're too tired to do much good in a library or anywhere else. Violet and Klaus looked at each other's tired faces, and then down at their baby sister, and they saw that the Quagmire triplets were right. Violet had been so tired that she had taken only a few notes on Mr. Romora's painfully dull stories. Klaus had been so tired that he had incorrectly measured nearly all of Mrs. Bass's objects. And although Sunny had not reported what she had done that morning in Nero's office, she couldn't have been a very good administrative assistant, because she had fallen asleep right there in the cafeteria, her little head on her salad as if it were a soft pillow instead of leaves of lettuce, slices of tomato, gobs of creamy honey mustard dressing, and crispy croutons, which are small toasted pieces of bread that give a salad some added crunch. Violet gently lifted her sister's head out of the salad and shook a few croutons out of her hair. Sunny winced, made a faint, miserable noise, and went back to sleep in Violet's lap. "Perhaps you're right, Isadora," Violet said. "We'll stumble through the afternoon somehow and get a good night's sleep tonight. If we're lucky, Vice Principal Nero will play something quiet at tonight's concert, and we can sleep through that as well." You can see, with that last sentence, just how tired Violet really was, because "if we're lucky" is not a phrase that she or either of her siblings used very often. The reason, of course, is quite clear. The Baudelaire orphans were not lucky. Smart, yes. Charming, yes. Able to survive austere situations, yes. But the children were not lucky, and so wouldn't use the phrase "if we're lucky" any more than they would use the phrase "if we're stalks of celery," because neither phrase was appropriate. If the Baudelaire orphans had been stalks of celery, they would not have been small children in great distress, and if they had been lucky, Carmelita Spatz would not have approached their table at this particular moment and delivered another unfortunate message.
"Hello, you cake sniffers," she said. "Although, judging from the baby brat, you're more like salad sniffers. I have another message for you from Coach Genghis. I get to be his special messenger because I'm the cutest, prettiest, nicest little girl in the whole school."
"If you were really the nicest person in the whole school," Isadora said, "you wouldn't make fun of a sleeping infant. But never mind, what is the message?"
"It's actually the same one as last time," Carmelita said. "But I'll repeat it in case you're too stupid to remember. The three Baudelaire orphans are to report to the front lawn tonight immediately after dinner."
"What?" Klaus asked.
"Are you deaf as well as cake sniffy?"
Carmelita asked.
"I said..."
"Yes, yes, Klaus heard you," Isadora said quickly. "He didn't mean that kind of what. We have received the message, Carmelita. Now please go away."
"That's two tips you owe me,"
Carmelita said, but she flounced off. "I can't believe it," Violet said. "Not more laps. My legs are almost too sore to walk, let alone run." "Carmelita didn't say anything about more laps," Duncan pointed out. "Maybe Coach Genghis is putting his real plan into action tonight." "In any case, we'll sneak out of the recital again and keep an eye on you." "In shifts," Isadora added, nodding in agreement. "And I bet we'll have a clear picture of his plan by then. We have the rest of the day to do research." Isadora paused and flipped open her black notebook to the right page. She read, "Don't worry, Baudelaires. Don't feel disgrace. The Quagmire triplets are on the case." "Thank you," Klaus said, giving Isadora a tired smile of appreciation. "My sisters and I are thankful for all your help, and we're going to put our minds to the problem, even though we're too exhausted to do research. If we're lucky, all of us working together can defeat Coach Genghis." There was that phrase again, "if we're lucky," coming out of the mouth of a Baudelaire, and once again it felt about as appropriate as "if we're stalks of celery." The only difference was that the Baudelaire orphans did not wish to be stalks of celery. While it is true that if they were stalks of celery, they would not be orphans because celery is a plant and so cannot really be said to have parents, Violet, Klaus, and Sunny did not wish to be the stringy, low-calorie vegetable. Unfortunate things can happen to celery as easily as they can happen to children. Celery can be sliced into small pieces and dipped into clam dip at fancy parties. It can be coated in peanut butter and served as a snack. It can merely sit in a field and rot away if the nearby celery farmers are lazy or on vacation. All these terrible things can happen to celery, and the orphans knew it. So if you were to ask the Baudelaires if they wanted to be stalks of celery, they would say of course not. But they wanted to be lucky. The Baudelaires did not necessarily want to be extremely lucky, like someone who finds a treasure map or someone who wins a lifetime supply of ice cream in a contest, or like the man, and not, alas, me, who was lucky enough to marry my beloved Beatrice and live with her in happiness over the course of her short life. But the Baudelaires wanted to be lucky enough, They wanted to be lucky enough to figure out how to escape Coach Genghis's clutches, and it seemed that being lucky would be their only chance. Violet was too tired to invent anything, and Klaus was too tired to read anything, and Sunny, still asleep in Violet's lap, was too tired to bite anything or anybody. And it seemed that even with the diligence of the Quagmire triplets, the word diligence here means ability to take good notes in dark green and pitch black notebooks. They needed to be lucky if they wanted to stay alive. The Baudelaires huddled together as if the cafeteria were extremely cold, wincing in soreness and worry. It seemed to the Baudelaire orphans that they wanted to be lucky more than they had in their entire lives. Chapter 9. Occasionally, events in one's life become clearer through the prism of experience, a phrase which simply means that things tend to become clearer as time goes on. For instance, when a person is just born, they usually have no idea what curtains are and spend a great deal of their first months wondering why on earth Mommy and Daddy have hung large pieces of cloth over each window in the nursery. But as the person grows older, the idea of curtains becomes clearer through the prism of experience. The person will learn the word curtains and notice that they are actually quite handy for keeping a room dark when it is time to sleep, and for decorating an otherwise boring window area. Eventually, they will entirely accept the idea of curtains and may even purchase some curtains of their own, or Venetian blinds, and it is all due to the prism of experience. Coach Genghis's SORE program, however, was one event that didn't seem to get any clearer at all through the Baudelaire orphans' prism of experience. If anything, it grew even harder and harder to understand, because Violet, Klaus, and Sunny became so utterly exhausted as the days, and, more particularly, the nights, wore on. After the children received their second message from Carmelita Spatz, they spent the rest of the afternoon wondering what Coach Genghis would make them do that evening. The Quagmire triplets wandered along with them, so everyone was surprised. The Baudelaires, who met Genghis out on the front lawn after dinner again, and the Quagmires, who tiptoed out of the recital and spied on them, in shifts, from behind the archway again, when Genghis began blowing his whistle and ordered the Baudelaire orphans to begin running. The Baudelaires and Quagmires thought that surely Genghis would do something far more sinister than more laps. But while a second evening of running laps might have lacked in sinisterity, Violet, Klaus, and Sunny were too exhausted to notice. They could scarcely hear the shrieks of Genghis's whistle and his cries of,
"Keep running!"
and
"Another lap!"
over the sound of their own desperate panting for breath. They grew so sweaty that the orphans thought they would give up the entire Baudelaire fortune for a good long shower, and their legs grew so sore that the children forgot, even with their prism of experience, what it felt like to have legs that didn't ache from thigh to toe. Lap after lap the Baudelaires ran, hardly taking their eyes off the circle of luminous paint that still glowed brightly on the darkening lawn, and staring at this circle was somehow the worst part of all. As the evening turned to night, the luminous circle was all the Baudelaires could really see, and it imprinted itself into their eyes so they could see it even when they were staring desperately into the darkness. If you've ever had a flash photograph taken, and the blob of the flash has stayed in your view for a few moments afterward, then you are familiar with what was happening to the Baudelaires, except the glowing circle stayed in their minds for so long that it became symbolic. The word symbolic here means that the glowing circle felt like it stood for more than merely a track, and what it stood for was zero. The luminous zero glowed in the Baudelaire minds, and it was symbolic of what they knew of their situation. They knew zero about what Genghis was up to. They knew zero about why they were running endless laps, and they had zero energy to think about it. Finally, the sun began to rise, and Coach Genghis dismissed his orphan track team. The Baudelaire stumbled blearily to the orphan shack, too tired to even see if Duncan and Isadora were sneaking back to their dormitory after their last shift of spying. Once again, the three siblings were too tired to put on their noisy shoes, so their toes were doubly sore when they awoke, just 2 hours later, to begin another groggy day. But, and I shudder to tell you this, this was not the last groggy day for the Baudelaire orphans. The dreadful Carmelita Spatz delivered them the usual message at lunch, after they spent the morning dozing through classes and secretarial duties, and the Baudelaires put their heads on the cafeteria table in despair at the idea of another night of running.